that the living principle would be carried across through the retorts and collected again through a process of distillation. Therefore, that the purification consisted of cycles of distillation. That these elements had to be completely distilled again and again until finally all gross matter, all impurity would be left behind. Therefore, that the bodies of these minerals and metals would die, because the bodies of them could never be united anyway. There is no union to be achieved on the level of matter. Therefore, it is only when all of these are again reduced to their soul equivalent, becoming invisible like the soul itself, but captured within the disciplines of consciousness, the recall, that they can be reunited to form the basic ingredients of the soul. Let's put that then onto another level of language and try to see what we are working with. Man experiencing his own emotions and experiencing his own thoughts is not long in realizing that they are not of a sufficient quality to sustain his natural spiritual aspirations. He must therefore go through the process of regenerating the various instincts, attitudes, appetites which he possesses, refining them towards the release of their soul's content. Let's take one example which will more or less convey the problem that we have in a simple way. Here's an individual, a person, who wishes to grow. But this individual is by nature jealous. Now, we might say that jealousy is an emotion which is, under some conditions, almost apparently justifiable. There are moments when it is exceedingly difficult for an individual not to express this very natural instinct. And yet, jealousy is an emotional pressure. Jealousy can only exist because man has a soul. The bees and the birds are not jealous. The universe beyond man is not jealous. Jealousy belongs to the soul complex in man. Therefore, it is a negative expression of soul energy. Now, we may say that jealousy is almost necessary to the human being, and that he is justified in preserving this faculty and in attempting to grow and develop and be good in spite of it. But here is the difficulty you are confronted with. The stone, which is the perfect soul, can never be cast if any of its elements are absent. And the elements of the soul must be created out of the purification of its own attributes. If jealousy remains, the soul can never be cast as the soul, because this would then become the flaw in the diamond. It would be a quality unregenerated or unredeemed, and therefore a stone not suitable to be built into the everlasting house. That particular stone had not been true. Therefore, it would not fit into the wall. And if it was taken to the wall, it would weaken the wall. In the alchemical symbolism, therefore, every one of the extensions of soul represented by the minerals and metals must be redeemed in itself before it can be mixed into the great compound of the molten sea. And the individual working with his alchemy, therefore, experiences within himself many emotions and instincts: fear, doubt, grief, pride, anxiety, worry, hate, criticism, condemnation, bigotry, prejudice. All of these are soul faculties to its basic elements. Knowledge and its effect upon man must be broken down. It must all be brought to a condition of calcination. Every idea the human being has must be tried by fire, and its dross must be burned away. To accomplish this is a great task, exciting the most earnest endeavors of the most thoughtful, conscientious, and courageous person. But by alchemy, gradually, all of these elements are reduced. And we have a very dissimilar state in other schools of mystical thinking. We have, for example, the Eastern system, where under the guru concept of instruction, the disciple is taught to unlearn what he has previously known, is taught to discipline himself against any extremes or intensities of his own disposition, and is finally shown how, through this complete regeneration of himself, to approach to the universal which lies beyond him. This is precisely the same implication as in the story of alchemy. Now, having assumed for the moment that we have a grasp of the problem of basic elements, now we must pass on to the next degree of the art of the soul. Actually, what the alchemist is attempting to produce here is not immediately the transformation of his own totality, but the production of the agent of this transformation. And this agent is the red lion. Now, the red lion, of course, is another solar or sun symbol. But it is a most particularly an alchemical device. It is the name given to the final formula and its production. Now, in alchemy, when all the elements and all the ingredients are brought together in an exactly perfect manner, and the experiment with all its rotations is carried through to the end, the adept achieves what is called the powder of projection. This is a small amount of an incredibly powerful agent. Paracelsus is said to have carried a small amount of this agent in the hilt of his sword after it was made for him and presented to him by the adepts of alchemy in Constantinople. The purpose of this agent is that it becomes universal in its application. It can perform any and all mysteries. One grain of this powder cast upon base metals will transmute 200,000 times its own weight into pure gold. One grain of this powder dissolved in wine will become the universal medicine and will keep the individual in the same condition of life forever. One grain of this mysterious power, if incorporated with certain ingredients and accepted into the system under a certain type of method, can produce all-knowing, and the power to read every secret locked in nature. Here is the diamond soul, the diamond stone. Here is the elixir of life. Here is the universal medicine. Here is the absolute transmuting agent. This mysterious power called the Red Lion. And the Red Lion is fashioned out of the complete agreement of the metals, in which all, having been reduced to their essential principle, they are fused together by one tremendous experiment. And out of that complete fusing, under terrific heat and combustion, yet in a completely sealed vessel, which must not leak or in any way weaken, under a strange and wonderful procedure, which appears as a miniature of the complete forming of the universe, The alchemist, watching his retort, sees cosmos emerge from chaos, sees the ordering of all life, beholds the thunders of heaven and the rumbles of the underworld, sees lightning flashes and creatures appear and disappear within the vessel. And finally comes the great quietude that follows all this tremendous combustion. And that which is in the bottom of the vessel when it is finished is this wonderful, radiant mass, shimmering, shining like the treasure of the Rhine Gold, a mysterious and priceless tincture which can become the complete mystery of universal power. What are we dealing with? What is the story? What is it that can transmute this tremendous mass of anything into true gold? Under the complete story of the casting of the stone, there's only one possible allegory that we can conceive of. The story taking place in the laboratory bottle is identical with the wonderful description given in the Eastern scriptures of the illumination of Buddha. The magnificent experience, which is the complete recapitulation of the spiritual life of man, is illumination itself. It is the achievement of universal consciousness. Therefore, consciousness in its universal state is the mysterious outer projection. This is the red light. For one grain of it can transform 100,000 times its own weight of error into pure truth. Wherever it is turned, whatever it is done, when it is done with it, it achieves the perfection of the great work. Universal consciousness sustains all things, preserves all things, and fulfills all things. Therefore, the true adept possessing the stone is the individual who has achieved universal consciousness within himself. This is his stone. Because from that time on, everything is transmuted by his own understanding. Everything is transmuted by his own spiritual internal. Sin and death vanish from the world because man understands through them. Ignorance is gone forever. And all the problems and burdens of worldliness are transformed into the blessed recognition of truth. So by means of consciousness, truth is revealed in all things. Now, says the alchemist, when this power of projection is placed in the 100,000 times its own weight of those metals, does it actually transform them? Does it take lead and change it into gold? The alchemist says, not in that way. He says the reason why lead can be transformed into gold is because the spirit of gold is already present in the lead. You can form no transmutation unless the spirit of the metal you seek is already present under the surface or under the appearance of something else. Therefore, the discovery of truth is not the manufacture of truth, but the recognition of ever-existing truth. Universal consciousness cannot create truth, but it can discover truth and augment it in all things by an alchemical process, revealing truth and making it available as a positive expression of consciousness. In the same way, the alchemist says that he can perpetuate life forever once he possesses the stone. The stone here, as universal consciousness, assures him of the absolute survival of life. It does not necessarily mean he will live in the same body forever, but having attained the internal enlightenment, there is no darkness possible, and the mystery of death is solved forever. Therefore, everlasting life is bestowed by consciousness itself. Now, all these things remind us to come back again for a moment to this problem of the soul and its part in this particular drama. Universal consciousness in man exists, but is locked away from his visible and knowable consciousness by something. The universal is not apparent or present, because in man, the personal is immediate and always in the foreground. Thus it follows that the soul, which is the seat of the personality in its present unredeemed state, divides man from the experience of reality. In order that consciousness, as the alchemical mystery, can exist within man, the soul must become the vehicle of that consciousness. And the soul, which is now the channel of desire, must become the vehicle of holy aspiration. Thus it is the fusing and mingling of the elements of the soul, producing their own magical and mysterious work, makes possible the revelation of consciousness through soul. And soul becomes the next body above man's present vehicle for the release and expression of soul for our spiritual power. Soul, therefore, is the natural body of consciousness in alchemy. And to attain the integration of that soul body is to release consciousness into manifestation and thereby make it available as the basis of the universal medicine and the wise man's soul. In this thinking, we have then another dimension of soul to consider. The messianic soul of the individual is one that has been accepted and believed for great periods of time by the devout of all nations. They have believed that within man is a saving self. This is rather an Oriental viewpoint, because in the West, man is seeking salvation from some source outside of himself. To the Western man, salvation is bestowed. To the Eastern scholar and mystic, salvation is obtained by the direct and conscious and purposeful effort of the self. Thus, in the alchemical tradition, which follows the Eastern way, because it probably originated in the East, the alchemist is the truth seeker who must perform his own experiment of regeneration, must find the stone himself. He will be assisted and guided according to his needs and integrity, but he must perform the work. And the work of regeneration for each individual must be performed by himself and represent the dedication of his own life and effort to the achievement of the end for which he was originally created and devised, the perfection of his own spiritual vehicle. If man is able to build the soul power within himself, the soul integration, he then releases from above a tremendous inflowing of the spiritual life behind him. The illumined soul becomes the natural instrument of consciousness. And we are capable then of achieving to a Buddhic state, or to participate in the principles which rest in the Buddhic level of consciousness. The individual must build this soul power himself. He must build this body and release the spiritual mystery through it. Otherwise, this mystery cannot be consummated in him. It cannot be done for him. But he can and does become the adept by the perfection of a soul vehicle suitable for this purpose. Now this brings us to a symbol in alchemy, which I think we should spend a little thought on, because it occurs so frequently and has had so many crisscross interpretations in its rather interesting descent. And that is the symbol of the rose. Now in many of the alchemical manuscripts which we have in the vault, the rose symbol occurs. We almost always think of it as an emblem of the Rosicrucians. But then again, this is only another name for part of the mystical revival that marked that period in European history. The rose occurs frequently in the alchemical bottles. And it also occurs in the symbolism of the troubadours. We find it arising in the stories of Dante and of Petrarch and of Boccaccio, all of whom were involved in this great revival of the troubadours. The rose, of course, is an acrostic for Eros, symbolizing pure love. The rose was also the symbol of secrecy. You will remember that Apuleius, transformed into a donkey by magic, was restored to his human shape when one of the priests of the Eleusinian Mysteries fed him a rose. The rose was also the crest of Martin Luther and occurs in many, many different symbolisms from the time when it is supposed to have grown from the blood of the slain god Adam. In the rose garden of Sardis, we find the mystic rose growing within the secret garden of the soul. Here we borrow from the Sufis and the Dervishes, who were also masters of alchemy in their own quiet way. They had many alchemical symbols and made much of these mystical experiments. The alchemical rose growing in a sealed bottle is the same as the rose of Sardis growing in a secret garden. The rose, of course, is again the symbol of the soul plant. The mysterious form of growth which is taking place within the life of the human being. In one alchemical symbol, the rose is shown growing out of the dead body of the disciple. The disciple lies dead upon the ground, and the rose is growing out of his heart. In another early symbol associated with the Rosicrucians, the rose is shown growing out of the top of a skull as a symbol of resurrection or the restoration of life. Man living in a material state still has locked within him the flower of his own soul, which is, of course, the rose of Sharon and the lily of the field. Now, in the course of growth, the inner or spiritual life of man is seen growing from the death, or from the death head of the skull, as a sign of the spiritual promise of soul power locked within body. Man's resurrection from the dead is life growing from death, and from his dead materiality. In the dismal failure of his material ambitions and purposes, must grow the flower of his own immortality. Each human being has this flower, which is also a symbolical alchemical plant. And occurring in the bottle of the alchemist is again the story of the growth of the mystical love under the warmth of the furnace, the warmth of holy aspiration and piety. The rose has many other interesting meanings. It represents, of course, in a way, the heart itself. And in the Rosicrucian emblems of the 18th century, a human heart was placed within the rose. And it also so occurs on some of the diagrams attributed to Gicto. All of these symbols tell us definitely that the rose is the soul plant. It is a symbol of the regenerated soul of man. This soul, growing out of body, becomes the vehicle of everlastingness or of universal consciousness in man. To bring this thinking down to the level of our own daily living, and trying to isolate some part of it that can be made immediately practical for us, let us imagine that we'll all become, for a while at least, philosophic alchemists. We're not going to go into those kinds of experimentations which might result in a sudden explosion in the backyard. We will refrain from that, but we will become philosophical alchemists. And with that thought in mind, what shall we do in order to understand alchemy? I think one of the first things we ought to do, perhaps, is to gain a little knowledge of the literature of this sect, to find out, in their own words and thinking, what they were trying to do. The second thing that I think we should bear in mind is that these European alchemists lived in a time in which the world was corrupt, selfish, chaotic, and that human life was in constant danger. because we live in much more fortunate times than then. We are just living in a time when we're not sure of anything. They lived under the fear of the Inquisition. We live under the fear of communism or something of that nature. But men live under fear. And let us point out that they will continue to live under fear by whatever name we call it until the human consciousness becomes greater than fear. Because there will never be a time when little people will not be faced with a problem bigger than themselves. The moment we get through with communism, we get something else. Because we have to live in the presence of challenge until we meet the challenge. And that we have consistently failed to do through the ages. So the adversary is nothing more or less than a great boogeyman composed of our own ignorance. And we are frightened out of our wits, not because of the strength of the enemy, but because of the weakness of ourselves. So the alchemist lived in a time when worldly conditions were unfavorable, and in times when his own nature was insufficient to his needs. We live in identically the same kind of times. A few centuries has made no marked difference. Therefore, his position was a very simple one. How can the individual gain ascendancy over the limitations which bind him? How can he grow? How can he become sufficient to his own internal and eternal need? Until he achieves this, there is no security for him here, and he faces the future with very little hope. Alchemy answers the question very simply. Nature must have the answers to all the secrets of the creatures which she has fashioned. Nature has pointed ways which we have not been wise enough to observe. Nature has sealed her book with 7 seals, and on each of the seals she has placed the symbol of an element, a metal, a mineral, a power. And she has locked this book with these seals, and the 7 seals of revelation are the seals of the human soul. And man himself must unseal and unlock the mystery of his own inner life. Now, when man goes inside looking for an inner life, he finds it a confused and inadequate one. He finds not decent security, but further chaos represented by a dragon. He realizes that his inner security has been in some way undermined, that he cannot go directly in and find God. The most that he can hope to find is a cherub with a flaming sword guarding the gate of paradise. He cannot simply go in. Therefore, his only reply to such a challenge as is confronting him is the unnatural and inevitable one. That as he examines his own inner life, he finds that his outer confusion is rooted there. He finds that his outer insecurity stems from his inner insecurity. That his inner life is also toxic, is also burdened with prejudices and weaknesses and failings, and that therefore his great work of regeneration and reorganization must begin where it is needed most, within himself. He also knows that it is most unlikely that he will be able to accomplish this regeneration simply by wishing it could happen, or even by hoping, or perhaps by faith or even prayer. He cannot learn to play the piano by prayer, so there is some doubt as to whether he can save his own soul that way. The only solution lies in the recognition that somewhere in nature there must be the secret keys to the art of perfecting nature, because nature itself is an orderly, systematic, wonderful, beautiful, unfolding form of life and activity. Therefore, the laws governing this must be available to the individual who will search for it. And there must also be arts and sciences by means of which the regeneration of man is possible. Alchemy then said, any one of the seven arts and sciences must also possess the key to all of it. The universe is one great pattern, and the laws governing one part are applicable to all other parts. Therefore, if we can master one art or science to its ultimate degree, we shall be in possession of universal knowledge. For we shall then know how to take that key and apply it to all other knowledge. Thus, performing a great transmutation. For we can put this power of projection that we have discovered in alchemy and apply it to all other sciences and transform them also, and discover the secret goal which is contained within them. So the Hermetic school took chemistry, involving most of the then known astrology, geology, and to a degree anthropology, as its field, declaring that there is no place in the universe where the immediate operations of nature can be more easily regulated than in the laboratory of experimentation. Even in science today, the same attitude is generally held. That which is demonstrated in the laboratory, we regard as highly factual. We are also learning from alchemy today that practically every conceivable discovery that man needs for the advancement of his own condition can be developed from a study of chemical reactions. We are mastering little by little mysteries of chemistry that even the alchemist did not know. But he, with one single broad sweep of analogical reasoning, conceived of the fact that there was a key to human regeneration identical with the chemistry of metals and minerals. If therefore he could solve one, he would solve the other. Though it is the same thing as someone taking up a study today. Let us say that someone decides to study Vedanta, or someone else decides to study Platonism, or another Buddhism. None of these things studied for themselves and by themselves and for the sake of learning will ever unfold their mysteries. You can study Platonism or Buddhism for 100 years and still end a materialist. You can study all of these things and at best achieve only to a state of philosophical idealism. You can recognize the value and the beauty and the dignity and the wonder of it all and still be exactly the same person you were before. Or very nearly so. Probably you cannot work with any subject indefinitely without a little of it rubbing off. But you can remain comparatively underprivileged in a world of opportunity. Alchemy, the chemist, decided the same thing. You could study chemistry from now on. And still, you would only be a gold maker, living in constant danger of blowing yourself into the other world by one of his own experiments. The solution did not lie simply on this development upon a level. But the alchemist discovered what the devout Platonist and the true Buddhist discovered, that the amount of learning that he can attain is geared very closely to the amount of acceptance which developed within his own nature. If, in his studies, he is receptive, if he is relaxed, if he makes quiet but natural use of the full endowment of his consciousness and mind, he gradually develops the ability to apperceive certain overtones. It gradually dawns upon him that the outer forms of things are but shells and shadows, and that each one of these processes locks within it a universal truth to be discovered by meditation upon the process, not by acceptance of the process alone. This is what Salomon Trismosen told us long ago in the study of alchemy. that by the contemplation of the laws governing chemical experimentation, man suddenly feels within himself the stirring of a creating power. He begins to feel chemistry. He begins to experience the moods of chemistry. And little by little, the bottles and the laboratories and the retorts sort of fade away. And the individual finds himself a magician in a living universe of elements and powers. By degrees, he gains an internal, intuitive insight into the truths behind the facts. And it is only when the truth is released from the fact that it becomes dynamic. The fact is chemistry. The truth is alchemy. Because the truth must be alive. It is a living spiritual law. A living experience discovery of something that actually happens, that something that which happens to the individual himself. I have coached and guided a number of operating alchemists in the course of years, trying to show them and help them in their own search for the various elements and metals of stone. And usually, I'm happy to report that after a certain degree of careful guidance without interference, each one comes and says, "At last, I think I begin to see what this is all about. I begin to realize that behind the experiment there is something else. And that in focusing upon this experiment to the performing of it, I am releasing an archetype. I am releasing out of myself a pattern conviction." And as one said to me, "If I ever succeed in the experiment of the transmutation of base metals, it is because I have released the true formula from within myself." That these formulas on paper are only catalysts, agents to direct attention, just like a written book on philosophy does not make a philosophic life, but may cause the individual to become concerned with this matter and to begin the release of his own soul symbolism through his own nature. Now this soul symbolism will carry the alchemist partway, because as he becomes more and more sensitive and more proficient, he is releasing from himself the complete chemical terms, the complete story of his own growth. He is telling us in the terms of metals and elements and bottles where he came from and how he got as far as he has. He is telling the story of his own growth, or rather the growth of his own soul from the germ within himself, from its own seed to its own final point of attainment. But in every instance, there comes a time when the alchemist catches up with his own soul symbolism. Remember, he has not made the soul. That is, he has not perfected the soul within himself. Therefore, he cannot complete his own formula. In some cases, the alchemist catches up to the degree of his own psychic revelation through alchemy in a year or 2 years of research. In some, it will take him 10 or 20 years to catch up, depending upon the amount of internal chemical symbolism he can release from his own psyche. Because his psyche is then only telling the story of itself under the symbolism of the art of chemistry. It chooses that vehicle because the alchemist has studied chemistry, because it has become the natural channel for the expression of his own internal. If that same artist had studied painting, then the psychic nature would come through in color, line, and composition. But it comes through chemistry to the chemist, and to the individual who has accepted the psychological challenge of chemistry as the key to universals. So the time comes when the alchemist catches up to himself and he's stopped. He cannot carry the experiment any further. because he has gone no further. Then he comes to the point where recapitulation, or the old cycles of augmentation, cease, and he stands in the presence of the new work. Now we find this not only in the case of alchemy, but we find it in the case of living. You'll find it in public schools. You will find that with each school child, there will come to the point where that child has reached as far as its own soul recapitulation will permit. From that time on, the education of that child becomes increasingly difficult. And under certain racial limitations and so forth, that will, our educational advancement usually ceases. The individual can't go any further because he has gone as far as he could. More correctly, he has gone as far as he has ever gone. And that means that from there on, life becomes new growth rather than recapitulation. And this is a much slower and more difficult problem. In alchemy, at this stage in the problem, the chemist becomes the hopelessly confused one who prays for assistance and guidance. And it is in these emergencies, if they are the genuine emergencies due to the individual having actually exhausted his own potential, and therefore justly caught up to himself, then it is that, as in the alchemical legend, alas, the artist appears, the adept self. The individual, having exhausted the content of his own psychic nature, must then begin original growth. And he does this not by continuing dependence upon the psychic nature, but by drawing upon the archetype. He has to go on into his own creativity. Therefore, alas, the artist appears, which is the adept self, a symbol of consciousness coming to the assistance of the mind. This cannot happen until the psychic load has been exhausted. Because until it is exhausted, it stands between the individual and any further growth. But when the negative part of the soul has been disproved and cast aside by art, and the positive achievements of the psyche have been released to their fullest extent, the individual is then caught up in himself totally, as far as a psychic being is concerned. Then on the outside symbolism, the old master comes and tells him what to do. On the inner psychic symbolism, he begins to draw upon archetype, or upon new work. Then he receives the new design, or the new symbol, which must carry him to the next degree. From that time on, instead of being built by soul, he begins to build soul. Because each individual is built by his soul to the degree that that soul has gone. And this has to be revitalized in each life. But having gone as far as his internal life has already proceeded, then it is necessary for him to begin new growth. And new growth calls upon a higher level than the psyche or its expression. New growth calls upon the archetypal source of life in the conscious basis of life. Therefore, the old teacher or the master becomes the archetypal impulse from the unconscious, which then must continue to build the soul, and can do so because the soul itself is no longer a conscious or integrated interference. The prejudice, conceits, opinions, theories, notions, beliefs, attitudes, all these things which have disfigured the soul have now been done away with by alchemy, by transmutation. The good parts of the soul have been fortified until the soul becomes, as far as possible, the wise teacher, as far as that lesson can be learned. Then the intercession comes from a superior archetypal self. For the soul must then turn, in its turn for guidance, to that which is superior to its own nature. So the old teacher comes as the impression of the purpose and the plan itself from the most internal parts of consciousness. And this becomes then the guiding principle to the alchemist from that point on. he then continues his positive growth. This is, again, participation in the universal consciousness, which then becomes his instructor. Man teaches himself from within himself as far as he can go. Then the universal consciousness takes over. And the universal consciousness then assists the individual to continue his growth as far as possible, and continues to do so life after life until the universal life itself is released. So we have two distinct types of teaching, or three in fact. We have man learning from the book, which is learning from the tradition and from the environmental world around him, the book and the laboratory. We have him learning from the inspirations of his own soul, and having achieved this level and consummated it, we then have his direct participation in the creative power of consciousness itself. And by means of this, consciousness then is gradually transformed into further soul power and continues to build the soul itself until the soul becomes a vehicle or instrument sufficiently perfect, sufficiently complete, like a body, that it can be unsouled or can receive into itself the consciousness, the personal consciousness of the individual. And by so doing, then the person becomes a living soul and has the adept experience or the adept life, having achieved the great work, and having transformed itself from a creature of the material world to a creature of the psychic world, or the world of soul. Now this does not mean that the adept necessarily disappears from humanity, but it means that his level of life within himself is on the level of enlightened soul, rather than on the level of externals. That he is the master of his destiny and the captain of his soul. And that at any time he so wills, he may experience his own adept existence. Because an adept, according to alchemy, is not one all the time. He is only an adept when he wills to be one. He is only an adept when the consciousness is required. Otherwise, he lives a very simple and normal life, a quiet life, like Elias Autista, who was unknown. But the adept has available the immediate contact with internals, and is therefore in a position to call upon faculties superior to those of the average person when the need arises. This is the alchemical approach to it. But I think it is very interesting and important to realize that the chemist reaches the point where he cannot go on without calling upon archetype. And in this begins his new work of proceeding as a creating chemist. And finally, through the acceptance of chemistry as a spiritual mystery of religion, and the practice of chemistry as a completely devotional art and science, the alchemist experiences the mystery of the metals. He experiences the universe as the great chemical mystery. And having so experienced it, becomes master of the elements and patterns of this chemistry. Well, our time is up, so we'll have to continue next week.